welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, the editor-in-chief of Rebeller. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you guys today?
Good.
Happy almost New Year.
Before we get started on this week's show, I want to tell you a bit about RebellerMedia.com. RebellerMedia.com is a one-stop shop for all your film writing needs. Every day, I and my crack team of editors will be gathering the most interesting movie news and essays on the web for you to browse through. Think of us a bit like the Drudge Report for Hollywood. We are aggregating without rewriting, just sending you off to those sites. Hope you enjoy it. After you are done checking out the day's headlines, we hope you'll stick around and enjoy some Rebeller originals. We have essays from critically acclaimed director S. Craig Zoller, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood editor Fred Raskin has written a very nice appreciation of Sally Menke for us. I hope you'll like that. We'll also have musings by yours truly, and we'll have some great critical voices like Outlaw Vern and Jacob Knight. We are paying good people good money for the content you're enjoying, including the content you are enjoying right now, and we hope you will sign up for a membership, which will give you unlimited access, either $2 per month or $20 for the year. There's also a free tier if you just want to try us out. And now, on to the show. First up, as always, is controversies and non-troversies. For this special year-end episode of Across the Movie Aisle, I have asked my co-hosts to choose either their most controversial or most non-troversial story of the year to share with us. So, Peter, what is your choice for most non-controversial or most controversial?
I'm going to go with the most non-controversial, there's going to be a secret, like stealthy, most controversial at the end, which is that people are upset about Rian Johnson ruining the character of Luke Skywalker. And there's a guy on Twitter, because everything happens on Twitter. That's the
things
real world.
Only happen on Twitter.
Podcasts are now just the commentary track to Twitter. And so there's a guy on Twitter who posts this like stupid screed about how Rian Johnson ruined the character arc of Luke and like was totally untrue to how Luke was in the original trilogy. And Johnson, because everybody is on Twitter now, Johnson actually responds to this, which I think was
terrible.
That might have been a controversy. And he says, well, you know, look, I understand that. I'm going to read here. Johnson replies, I understand that point of view, but I completely disagree with it. In fact, I think it disrespects the character of Luke by treating him not as a true mythic hero overcoming recurring wounds and flaws, but as a video game character who has achieved a binary permanent power-up. So I had issues with The Last Jedi, as people know, but I also think it contains some really strong stuff, especially in the way that it treated Luke and in the way it turned him into a sort of a somewhat embittered mentor character. So I like Johnson's reply here just sort of seems the smarter of the bunch. But what was really interesting to me was that you also have J.J. Abrams' editor kind of piling on Johnson and saying that, in fact, the big mistake of The Last Jedi was to kill Luke, and that's like, well, that's not how you develop a franchise, and you can't tell a whole story. And if you go and look at some of the reporting, the rumor, not confirmed, but the rumor is that Colin Trevorrow, who was originally supposed to direct The Rise of Skywalker, got fired from the project by Kathleen Kennedy for wanting to keep Luke alive. And so the actual controversy in all of this is that Kathleen Kennedy launched a multi-billion dollar franchise as like an exercise in Mad Libs or something, where it's just like, well, you tell the first part of the story and we'll hand it off to the
totally.
Next guy who will figure out what to do with what you did, and then the next guy will figure out what to do with that material. And what happened was they all ended up basically writing stories that canceled the one that came before it.
This is totally true. We were discussing this before the show today. I think that the simple fact of the matter is that the last three Star Wars films in the Skywalker saga are a total disaster, and they're a total disaster because there is no vision here. And the reason there's no vision here is because Kathleen Kennedy was like, we'll give it to one director, then we'll give it to another, we'll let them write their own things. And that's insane. That is you cannot run a franchise that way. You need somebody with, and you need someone with a vision to say, okay, this is what we're doing, get us there.
Yeah, no, it's insane. I mean, I have said and written that I feel like I wished on a monkey's paw for more Star Wars movies and for a woman to run a major franchise. And I got both of those things together. And it has been so horrible. I mean, it's been flames on the side of my face, infuriating. But how, if you want to tell a three-part story and you don't have any idea what that story is, like, how do you get the money to do it? I don't understand, right? Like, the only blessing in all of this is that Kathleen Kennedy has been allowed to fail as abysmally and at this equivalent expense as, like, any mediocre white dude. So I guess it's a blow for equality, but it is so awful.
To be fair, she was helped quite a bit by picking the most mediocre of mediocre white dudes. Like, J.J. Abrams is, like, an exemplary mediocre white dude in this.
That's crazy.
That's nonsense. No, I mean, in his storytelling sensibility. He tells exactly the same sort of generic story about how it's just, like, good to be good, and, like, it's, being a Star Wars fan is about being a Star Wars fan and loving Star Wars, and there's no, right, and there's not.
That's all that Star Wars is, though. I mean, I once again, I said this last week on last week's episode, but, like, the idea that we need to, like, really probe for intellectual depth in Star Wars strikes me as an enormous mistake.
Intellectual depth, yes, that's not what I'm looking for. What I'm looking for is a rich pop culture synthesis, new worlds, and characters that I care about, and I didn't get any of that.
Alyssa, what was the most controversial or most non-controversial story of the year?
The most non-controversial story of the year was the fact that people thought it was problematic that Harvey Weinstein got heckled at a comedy club. If we can agree on anything in this fallen world, and I'm not sure that we can, it's that Harvey Weinstein should be heckled forever. He is a serial rapist. He is an alleged serial rapist. He has not gone on trial for any of these crimes. I do not want to be sued by Harvey Weinstein, but Harvey Weinstein should be heckled into oblivion. He is the one person who I hope...
Free pass. Free heckle pass.
Yes. No, the idea that...
Well, this was a weird story, too, though, because what happened was a stand-up comedian saw him come into, like, essentially some sort of charity set or something, and she started blowing him up from the stage. And then people in the crowd were like, boo, be nice to Harvey Weinstein.
Right. Which
I was like, what? Who are these people?
Right, and it's not just, I mean, I don't, like, Harvey Weinstein no longer has a movie studio to run and is unlikely to ever again. He is no longer married to, like, an influential fashion designer who can dress people. He had arguably, like, an incredibly corrupting influence on American culture in that, like, he leveraged, you know, basically non-consensual sex for roles in movies. Like, there's no one, like, what does anyone have to gain from Harvey Weinstein's, like, reintegration into society? I mean, I think it's, like, if he wants to go, like, work in the salt mines and, like, actually try and make up for anything he's done, like, there can be a point at which maybe people can weigh in on whether he should be forgiven. But, like, it's been 2 years since all of this happened. And he just now reached a settlement, like a group settlement with a bunch of his alleged victims. And the idea that, like, poor Harvey Weinstein has suffered enough.
Yeah.
Like, some minor rudeness?
Will be hard to get him to suffer amount.
If it's the comedian on the stage heckling him, then it's not heckling as we think of the kind of heckler's veto might object to. The comedian is the person who is being paid to get on stage and say stuff, and it's fairly common in stand-up comedy for there to be some interaction with the audience. Yeah. If the comedian chooses to initiate that with a target in the audience, that seems like a completely different thing than saying, oh, people are upset that somebody got bothered, you know, when, like, dinner. No,
right.
you go there, and it, like, frankly, anybody who goes to a comedy set has, there's a possibility that you might get made fun of.
But especially
Harvey Weinstein.
But also, I will just straight up advocate that, like, I think it is okay to deny Harvey Weinstein a reservation at your restaurant. I think it is okay to be, like, you know, if you see him walking down the street and you want to, like, tell him he's a jerk.
Boo, Harvey.
Yeah, right.
I'm a little more hesitant on that. I'm the variety of person who, like, doesn't necessarily think we should go down the street, like, screaming at heretics, even the really bad ones. But
can I just have one heretic? Like,
sure.
Just
you
one.
You can have one. Everyone gets a free one.
Yeah.
Every time I see Sonny, I tell him how bad the Snyder Watchmen is.
You do. It's really annoying. We're going to have a chat about that in the new year. All right. The most non-controversial story of the year, objectively speaking, this is just objectively speaking, the biggest non-controversy of the year was Joker. Here is a flick that critics predicted would spark riots and cause all sorts of violence and, you know, and tell all the wrong people in the world that they are okay to do the terrible things that they do. And instead, it sparked nothing more than great conversations about a fine piece of filmmaking. Guys, aren't you a little bit surprised that one of the best movies of the year, Joker, Todd Phillips' Joker, one of the great works of the year, caused such a to-do in the world of social media?
No. I mean, we all know that people don't watch things before they talk about them. Like, I think ultimately the discourse about it was silly, but I'm not sure it was surprising.
I think it was surprising in that it was partially led by critics who had seen the movie, that the suggestion that the movie would cause violence was not strictly limited to people just spouting off a month before the film came out.
Including people who saw it and liked it, which was kind of the most interesting part of it.
Yeah.
You know, people who saw it and liked it were like, oh my God, this movie is so good, but maybe it shouldn't even exist. And I was like, oh, I don't know.
And what frustrates me, and maybe doesn't surprise me as much, but what frustrates me is that that kind of discourse around a film just ends up leaving us not talking all that much about the movie. And the movie itself, I think we have some disagreements about, although...
you think it's one of the best movies of the decade, and I just think it's one of the best movies.
I think it's a really well-made movie and also kind of awful. But, you know, since I've got Skywalker on the brain here, it's a much better made movie than Skywalker is, and it's really a kind of it's a good counterpoint to Rise of Skywalker in that it is a movie that is idea driven. I think in some ways kind of hollow and bad ideas, but somewhat idea driven. And it is really immaculately well made. It is just an exceptionally well crafted movie that that I happen to find somewhat repulsive in the way that it went about doing what it was doing, but it's a useful counterpoint in thinking about what makes different types of movies distasteful or bad.
Okay, up this week, we have another Netflix movie, and one, frankly, you guys, that I'm a little bit disappointed did not get a Roma or Irishman style awards season push. That is right. We are talking about The Height of Cinema from A Legend of the Form 6 Underground by Michael Bay. The plot is pretty simple. A tech billionaire fakes his own death so he can form a band of vigilantes who go around the world taking out baddies. Not your normal everyday baddies, but like dictator baddies, you know, real baddies. It is very Michael Bay. There are lots of quick cuts and fast action shots and then close-ups on faces where guys are like shifting gears, and then you cut to the squealing tires, and then the squealing tires
butts. You forgot the butts.
Well, the squealing tires go to the bullets that are spewing out of the guns, and then we see the those shots of the women in the skirts, and then we go back to the close-ups on the faces where the guy's shifting again, and you're like, well, I mean, I'm pretty sure this is a metaphor for sex, but whatever, it's fine. It does also have the best visual metaphor for a work of art that I think I've ever seen. In the early going of the movie, the team drives a neon green Alfa Romeo through a museum filled with priceless works of Renaissance art and smashes them to bits, just destroys them everywhere. And you know, you can tell what Michael Bay is saying. He's saying the future is here, motherfuckers, and it's not stopping for no one, especially those limp dick statue making old dudes.
It's definitely the first movie I've ever seen with a statue of David dick joke.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. Alyssa, how much did you love Six Underground?
Sorry. I wouldn't say I loved Six Underground. I will say it was even more Michael Bay than I thought I was going to be getting. And whether that's a good thing is up to you. I mean, it's a genuinely hilarious movie in that it's both like an incredibly cynical argument that world governments will never actually do anything to...
What's cynical about that?
But also that, like, a small group of truly committed people can change the world.
Well, it is.
We privatized world peace.
No, it is. It is. So it is. It's a fascinatingly, like, kind of neocon libertarian fusion that is also, like, essentially,
if we just let
Chomsky-esque, yeah. Right? Like, America, like, this movie is such a Rorschach test because it can basically back up any worldview. There's a line early on about how, like, the United States created this dictator who they want to unseat, right? And then there's also the, like, libertarian, you know, non-governmental actors who are going to go out there and make everything right.
You should
right.
have just let Peter Thiel rescue those kids in that cave.
Totally.
I mean, come
totally.
On. But no, it's simultaneously incredibly cynical and so profoundly, bizarrely naive. And it also basically includes a recreation of Muammar Gaddafi's murder minus the sodomization with a bayonet.
I thought that was what they were going for. Again, it was
100%,
like,
right?
I was like, once again, this is like the kind of like, this is like the Hillary Clinton mode of world peace and governance. I was like, okay, that's, you know,
it's,
all right.
I mean, the movie's just incredibly postmodern, right? It's like, it's hard to talk about in any sort of serious way because it's so self-aware and simultaneously incapable of self-reflection. It's sort of like the height of Ryan Reynolds, too, in the, like, this is the obvious logical progression of the sort of winky looking at the camera, like, I'm sort of in on the joke, but also totally committed to the bit. I mean, it's such a silly, weird movie that I was sitting there watching it. It's like, this, come on, this can't really be what happens, right? Right? I mean,
but it is what happens.
Michael Bay meets the algorithm, right? Like, I can imagine that he sat down with Netflix and was like, show me what people rewatch in my movies. Like, I want to know exactly what people like most about that my work. And it's like, in a weird way, he and Steven Soderbergh are the perfect directors for Netflix.
So it just to for people keeping track at home, last week it was Michael Bay and the Coen brothers on the same level. As directors of actors, and this week it is Michael Bay and Steven Soderbergh as craft artists.
Well,
the craft of filmmaking.
But it's for totally different reasons, right? Because Soderbergh is obviously taking Netflix and using this opportunity to make a bunch of, like, sort of small, weird movies. The Laundromat, which I hated. High Flying Bird, which I actually like quite a bit. And Michael Bay is taking it as an opportunity to be as a sort of, like, the crassest, most expansive version of himself.
It's a process of self-discovery.
Yes, yeah, surrender to the algorithm and all will be revealed, Sonny.
Peter!
We watched Pain and Gain last week, and, you know, if you've seen that movie, it proves definitively that Michael Bay knows about protein shakes. I don't think anybody could have any, right? You watch that movie, he has studied the art of protein shakes, which means he owns a blender. And my question is, does he use the same blender to edit his movies that he makes his protein shakes in? Because that is all I could think about watching Six Underground, is that Michael Bay has taken a kind of aggressive, flashy editing style and simply and made it now the only thing he does. And I think there's a way in which I want to like or at least appreciate Six Underground. I can't say I actually enjoyed watching it all that much. It's almost impossible to follow in any conventional sense. It's just a sort of 2-hour-ish montage. Yeah, you can get from beat to beat. Like,
yeah,
there's basic.
I totally disagree with this. I mean, it is simple to the point almost of like being a connect the dot puzzle. You're just going. He's leading you by the nose. There's nothing particularly complicated here. I mean, the only complicated thing about it was that initial bit where they're hopping back and forth from like 4 years ago, 6 months ago, now, and I was like, why are we doing this? Just tell the story.
But also,
that goes away.
It felt. I mean, it's so frenetic. It's so hectic. And yet, there's something kind of impressive about Michael Bay's just deep commitment to chaos. And also, the other thing that struck me once again from Michael Bay is how willing he is to recycle big big set piece moments. And so we've seen that, we talked last week in the Pain and Gain a bit about how he has these chase sequences that he repeats, and you see them. There's one in Bad Boys 2, one in Bad Boys, one in The Island, one in one of the Transformers films, I think it's number 3, where you have these truck chases where there's stuff coming out of a truck and the good guys have to dodge it, or sometimes the good guys are throwing it at the car that's chasing them. Either way, it's like very, very similar action sequence. And here you have the magnet sequence again. And if you've seen Transformers 4, I believe it is, it's the one that ends in Hong Kong with the dinosaurs and Stanley Tucci in a really crazy suit. The end of that movie has a gigantic magnet.
I did not remember until you said dinosaurs. I was like, oh, yeah, that's
right. A gigantic magnet that floats over Hong Kong and goes on and off and sucks everything into the air and then drops it and then sucks it right. And actually, it's a really cool set piece. It's just like the coolest, Mike. It's one of the coolest things Michael Bay has ever put together. And so I was a little bit surprised to see, or maybe not surprised. I thought it was noted. Yet again, there is a giant magnet sequence in which the magnet gets turned on and off, and it's all about sort of, right, oh, is it the characters having to react to, like, everything being suctioned to one wall or the other while they're navigating gunshots and
butts.
Right, I mean,
Michael Bay movies are the only way that it's legal to get high in all 50 states and the territories. Right? I mean, and they have this way of turning, like, part of what's so fascinating about watching Six Underground and Pain and Gain close together is, you know, what I was talking about last week, which is that Bay is capable of being a sort of moral and finely directed filmmaker and just chooses not to be most of the time. And Six Underground is in certain ways a profoundly immoral movie. I mean, the sort of like nastiness of, you know, the death of the dictator, the civilian casualties, like the sort of crudeness.
So many civilian casualties, like, in a way that is weirdly bothering, it because it's supposed to be a fantasy. It's supposed to be a lark. And then you just got people, innocent people, just being mowed down.
Either run over and like
by the
over
heroes
cars.
All the time.
No.
In the opening sequence, it's by the heroes.
I don't think they hit anyone with the car, they're driving.
Okay.
I don't think,
but it's like,
but with Michael Bay, no, but who can tell?
But there is that great shot in the opening sequence in which the car is spinning around in a circle and Ryan Reynolds is like, baby, and then like 2 seconds later, it's like, dog, puppy, or whatever. And it is clearly mocking the idea of, like, oh, no, we have to look out for these civilian casualties. In the same way that in Batman vs. Superman, there's this tossed-off line by Anderson Cooper where he says, thankfully, the downtown core is empty right now. And you can just kind of see Zack Snyder making a jack-off motion in the background. Like, you know, angry about all the people who whined about Man of Steel. It feels like the same kind of thing is going on there. Peter, I have to say I was a little bit surprised at how negative you have been about this movie in our little GG chats / emails. Because if you can get on board with Michael Bay's aesthetic, and I think all of us here more or less can, this is the, like, ne plus ultra of that. It is Bayhem at its best, I think, frankly. More so than the Transformers movies, which I think take that Blender aesthetic and, like, ramp it up to 79. I can't watch those movies because they are too haphazardly put together. But this, I think, was actually relatively staid by Michael Bay standards in terms of the editing.
So I think for the same reason that just because you love a rare 16-ounce steak does not mean you want to eat a live cow, the amplifying the essential tendencies of Michael Bay can only go so far. The other problem I had with this is that, unlike The Irishman, which is a movie that is best watched at home in a situation where you can sort of take it leisurely, you can get up a little bit.
Wrong.
This is a
That's
movie,
actually wrong.
I think Six Underground would have played much better in a movie theater where I would have had to sit there, like, have had a ridiculous surround sound system, sort of been overwhelmed by it, and just been allowed to kind of sit and bathe and take in. And the home environment is not great for a movie like this because it allows you to your attention to drift. It allows you to kind of not become completely overwhelmed and fully submerged in the Bayhem, is part of the pleasure of a Michael Bay film.
You don't watch Michael Bay movies, you submit to them, right? And
yes.
You know, at home, you can be reminded that this is sort of, a lot of it's kind of screwed up or gross or unpleasant. And what,
I'm racking my brain. I can't think of any of those.
Make that face at me, Sonny.
I don't understand.
Yeah, no. I mean, you're supposed to be the person who's like super supportive of coups here.
I am. This is a great coup.
It's a terrible coup. You think that brother is going to like be able to hold the country of Turkestan together for more than like 30 seconds?
You know, you can't.
Absolutely not.
You can never predict which way these things are going to go. Sometimes they work. Sometimes they don't. You just got to break things. Get in there and break things.
But so.
It's funny. I say that. I had not really thought about this, but they really are taking a like Facebookian approach to world peace. You know, just break shit. See what happens. I have to say, I am a little bit surprised that you guys didn't like this as much as I did, because it is, and I will say that this is the first movie that Netflix has released that I am angry, that I'm actually angry that I don't get to see in IMAX, because it is a 100% a movie that deserves to be seen in the biggest possible format.
Unleash the Bayhem!
That was my one big takeaway, because I was sitting there, I actually watched it in a hotel room in Dallas on my laptop with headphones on, which like the headphones were good, but the laptop experience was not ideal. In part because I like would occasionally get an email and be like, okay, I have to answer that, and I would not frequently bother to pause where I was in the film. I just kind of let it keep going because the Bayhem just goes, man.
And that's right, is that in the home environment, it becomes kind of background noise. And that's true even, so I watched it on a giant television with 7-speaker surround sound in my basement. Ooh. And even still, it was like, oh, am I going to check Slack? Am I going to, right, my dog is having an anxiety attack. Yes, I did for about five minutes in the middle of this.
That's not surprising.
And it was like, I wanted to appreciate this movie more because I often like the way that Michael Bay goes about things. His maximalism is kind of appealing in it. There's something appealing about it. I thought it was a little bit over. It was just a little bit too much in this one. And I also think that the Netflix environment, the home theater environment, is not the right way to see it.
Can we also just note the somewhat surprising prudishness of the film? There's a lot of bra sex, is what I'm saying. There's for a movie that is like big and vulgar and garish and over the top and clearly R-rated, and there's like a guy, Ryan Reynolds, dangles an eye from an optic nerve for like 5 minutes in the beginning of the movie.
Not just that, there's a bunch of jokes about how maybe they're gonna crush it with their feet.
You see like RPGs go through people's heads. I mean, like, it is for all of the like big over the topness of it, there is still a squeamishness about sex that again leads me to there's this continuous undercurrent of like conservative Puritan anxiety in his movies that I think is most obvious here. Even in Pain and Gain, there's like a little bit of nudity.
But in a
strip club sequence where like if there wasn't something, somebody would like cry foul. But like in this movie, I mean, you have actresses who like have not been known to be squeamish about, you know, performing nude scenes. You have like extras who are clearly strippers and prostitutes who like just kind of cavort around in their underwear, and yet no nudity. And I'm not saying,
I wonder if this is because Bay perceives his audience actually as 10 to 12 year old boys, and he has basically said this. There was a quote he gave when somebody was complaining about the Transformers movies, and he just said something like, I make movies for 8 year old boys, get over it.
Right, but I mean, then this gets to another kind of deeper question about like our rating system and how it works. Like,
well, and I'll just be honest, like I trust Michael Bay to blow things up, but I don't trust him to direct a sex scene in which a heterosexual man knows what to do with bare nipples.
Fair enough. All right. And finally, we turn to assigned viewing. No more of this sex talk. We got to stop that. Up this week is Punch Drunk Love, one of my favorite iterations of Serious Sandler. I love Serious Sandler. Peter, why are we watching Punch Drunk Love by the great Paul Thomas Anderson this week?
We are watching it because it is an example of an a good Adam Sandler performance, and perhaps the best example is that we think of Adam Sandler as just this perpetual goofy man-child who makes movies like Little Nicky and has a Netflix deal where he makes stuff about farting donkeys. And I don't actually know if he's made that movie. I just assume he has. But Paul Thomas Anderson, the director of this movie, saw in Adam Sandler the capacity for greatness and for a great performance. And I think he really got a wonderful and nuanced and sensitive performance out of him. Adam Sandler plays a salesperson who falls in love and also finds a little tiny piano and eats a lot of pudding. And I don't want to say much.
He doesn't eat the
pudding. Sorry. Who buys a lot of pudding and then trades it in for airline tickets, which is a real thing. This is based on a story of a real person. And it's this marvelously bizarre and quirky film that also gets at the weirdness of love. And that's something you see in Paul Thomas Anderson's films pretty frequently. I really like this movie. It's short, it's weird, it's funny without being jokey. And it is a movie that proves that one of the talents of a good director is not just framing shots or writing stories or pacing things, but identifying essential qualities within performers and then figuring out how to use them in ways that are new and interesting.
So I had never seen Punch Drunk Love before this, and it took me 4 days to watch it because it made me so anxious that I could only watch it like 20 to 30 minutes at a time.
Why was that?
So it's two things. The score just did something to my brain and completely freaked me out. I found it's so tense.
It's this sort of chamber pop thing by John Bryan, who is a pop producer.
Yeah, and it really, really got to me. But also, I was just terrified of Sandler's character the entire time. And I know the movie sort of frames him as like he has these fits of rage, but he doesn't actually want to hurt anyone. And he's kind of put on by the sisters. But I just found him so frightening that it was very hard for me to spend time in his company in a movie that felt that sympathetic to him. And I think this is a classic example of a movie is I can see how good it is, right? I mean, the score is extremely effective, even if the effect it had on me was just sort of make me want to crawl under my desk and die. Sandler is extremely good, as is everyone else in it. But it was just, I don't know if it was this week or this year or this decade, but it was so not a movie for me that it was incredibly hard to watch.
Well, I have always thought the best way to think of this movie is as a sort of formal experiment, which asks, what would the world look like if somebody acted like a sitcom character for real in it? It takes a lot of the like tropes of a sitcom, like a guy freaking out in a bathroom and like, I'm freaking out, I'm on this day, and like demolishing it and like, oh, that would actually be terrifying and frightening. Yeah. That would actually be scary. Or getting into like a weird, you know, series of hijinks with like with the phone sex operators, right? Getting like, oh no, this is funny and cute. No, it would actually be really scary if you had like a gang of Mormons trying to, you know, come to your house and beat you up and take all your stuff because you got into a phone sex chat with some, you know, some person. By the way, Philip Seymour Hoffman, great in this movie.
He's so good.
It is one of my favorite Philip Seymour Hoffman performances. Just the one scene where he starts shouting, "Shut up. Shut up! Shut!" I love that so much. This is how I watch this movie is like kind of as again an almost experiment showing how the world would look if the things we saw in movies and on TV were real. And that's why I think Adam Sandler is actually the perfect person for this sort of role, is because he often plays that Happy Gilmore, Billy Madison like character where you're like, oh, he's being violent, but it's funny because he's being violent
or it's cute.
This movie came out in 2002 before it was at least one of, if not the first example of Sandler showing that he had more range than his sort of early career would suggest. And it took the essential character of early Sandler, the guy who was sort of geeky and awkward up until the moment that he just completely exploded, right? Or the kind of classic Sandler joke of, I'm someone who can't control the sound of my voice, right?
That was you're thinking of the Will Ferrell character who has voice modulation disorder.
Either way, right? It's one of these guys who he is somebody who just has, like, will just snap into moments of, like, either rage or high emotion. And Paul Thomas Anderson had this idea of, what if we took that and made a kind of a literary character out of it and built a literary story out of it rather than an easily accessible comedy for teen boys.
Yeah. And I think part of it is that Emily Watson's character feels so – it's like she's in a cult or something, right? I mean, the movie does nothing to explain to you why he would be attractive to her at all. She just sort of is. And it's – there's this horror movie quality to it because, you know, we live in a political moment very far divorced from the moment when Punch Drunk Love was made, when there are people who believe that they are entitled to sort of women's kind of slave-like affection. And this is, I imagine that this is sort of what that looks like. And it, I just found it so scary and upsetting. I had a really hard time with it.
Yeah, you're going to have a hard time with Uncut Gems, which is the reason we are watching this week, is because we have Uncut Gems coming up. And I think that is going to be another movie that might, for different reasons, it is another, like, very tense movie where, like, a lot of, like, things happen that you just want to stop happening.
Have you guys both seen Phantom Thread, which is does yes. not have Adam Sandler, but is a Paul Thomas Anderson film? And it is another romance that is bizarre and is about two people who in some ways aren't obviously, right? The connection between the two isn't, it's not a happy, easy romance. And it's this weird thing where Anderson seems to kind of be making the argument that love is violence, but it's like a combination of, like, violence and trust, right?
Well, I mean, The Master makes the same argument to a certain extent.
Yes, and it is, and it's really apparent here in Punch Drunk Love in a way that, right, there's that scene in which they're like, I want to eat you up, I want to bite you, right? And it gets, yes, I see Alyssa cringing here, and I can see that, but there's also, to me, there's something really truthfully romantic about it, about that little scene, about this way that real love, that deep commitment is a metaphor, is like metaphorically like consuming and becoming another person. And right, and you sort of, you become that other person and that other person becomes you and you desire to become that other person. And Anderson deals with like the kind of deep core of human desire in a way that very few other contemporary filmmakers even try, like he barely try, and he gets at a lot of that, like the weirdness that is in the human heart and that is in our kind of base emotions in a way that I just don't see very often on screen, and that comes out a lot in Punch Drunk Love.
Well, and I think for me it's an excellent example of a movie where I can see how well made it is and recognize that it's not for me without thinking that it's necessarily immoral or poorly made or poorly calibrated. I mean, one of the things about appreciating art and being able to see it for its formal qualities is to be able to recognize that your reactions are not necessarily objective, that, you know, a movie like this makes you feel something really human, and that is a measure of its power, even if it's not a pleasant experience.
All right, that is it for Across the Movie Aisle this week, presented by Rebeller. Please go to rebellermedia.com and sign up for a membership. If you don't sign up, I'm going to make Peter hit that mic stand every time, and you're going to be annoyed. You're going to be annoyed by it. If you loved us, please tell your friends and review us at Apple. We need those reviews, people. If you didn't love it, please complain to me on Twitter at SunnyBunch. I will convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sunny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman. Produced by Sunny Bunch and Natasha Passetta. Executive producer, Dallas Sonier. Associate producer, Jessica Safavamir. Art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording, design, and mixing by Sunny Bunch, with music by James Malone.